Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're joined by Daryl Good, agricultural economist at the U of I, to talk about the marketplace and his time here on the Urbana-Champaign campus. Daryl, thanks for being with us. Let's start off with the market over the last year and what it's been like for producers, in your opinion.
Well, I think when we look at corn and soybeans, a little bit of a dichotomy there. Corn prices have been generally low for an extended period of time, you know, in the mid $3 range or lower at times. I think reflecting very abundant U.S. supplies of corn, even though South America did experience a shortfall in this past summer, world supplies were still ample and was really not enough to push prices above that $4 mark that we're all looking for, except for a brief period during the summer weather concern. So it's been, I think, kind of a disappointing year from a producer standpoint, and not many pricing opportunities and generally low corn prices. Soybeans have been a little better overall, surprisingly high in many respects, given the size of the U.S. crop this year, record yields, particularly in Illinois, but prices have held in that $10 range, receiving a lot of support from the soybean oil market early in the year on reports of a shortfall in Malaysian palm oil production that kind of raised the whole boat for vegetable oil prices, and then very robust import demand of vegetable oils from India, and then more recently the EPA announcement relative to advanced biofuels that kind of lit another fire under the soybean oil market. So we've continued to see big yields, big crops, and $10 beans, so that's been a pleasant surprise, offsetting some of the disappointment in the corn market.
Oftentimes in the last couple of weeks, including yourself, we've heard brokers and others say you should maybe look at selling some soybeans, whether that's old or new crop. In particular for new crop, if additional acres are coming into the mix, that you might want to do that. Why would you believe that to be the case?
Well, I think you're exactly right in terms of on a supply side, that with a rebound in South American production expected, and really no reason not to believe that at this point. And then the expectation that U.S. producers will respond with more bean acres next year does point to another year of very big supplies and potentially a further increase in our carryover situation at the end of the 17-18 marketing year. And so we're kind of scratching our head saying, you know, this is well known, this is well anticipated, yet the market continues to offer $10 for harvest delivery next year in much of Illinois. So we think that with this expectation of an increase in acreage, that some pricing should be done on the 2017 crop. How that's done, whether it's hedging or cash contracts or using some kind of option strategy, I think it's prudent to get some protection in place on next year's beans.
Corn is a different story in many respects. I suppose for both old and new crop, there's an awful lot of corn that's still in storage across the United States. Producers often are told corn in their hands is weak, and that when it's moved into the commercials' hands are strong. They'd like to wait for a stronger price. Will there be opportunities, do you suppose, in the spring months? There normally are.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised that there is. One thing we want to see in the meantime is just how big those current stocks are when the USDA releases its December 1 corn stocks estimate, the second week of January. That's going to give us a good barometer of how big a pile of corn we've got out there and how much supply we have to overcome the last part of the marketing year. But assuming that that's within expectations, then we'll be looking to kind of the springtime period, planting time into the early growing season for some potential rally in the corn market. The assessment, I think, is that between now and then, there's perhaps not a lot of downside risk for corn prices. Whether or not we get that spring rally is yet to be determined, but might be worth waiting on at this point particularly for new crop corn. Time will eventually run out on old crop, but I still think patience will pay off here for both old and new crop.
Any other little tidbits that producers should be aware of as it relates to marketing either the old or new crop corn or soybeans?
You know, I don't think any really specific tip. I think it's a risk management thing at this point. We'll always be anxious now to see where prices are in that insurance pricing period in the month of February, see how much downside protection that's going to provide for us. But I think right now it's get something covered on beans, patience on corn.
This is the last time you and I may talk, relatively speaking, as a commodity analyst. You've been at this for about 40 years, retiring very shortly from the University of Illinois, and then over the next several months working your way out of the FarmDoc team. Congratulations, first of all, and thank you very much for all the time that you have spent with me and teaching me over the years. It has made a difference in the way I think that I talk about the marketplace, and I wanted to thank you for that as well.
Well, it's been a pleasure to work with you, Todd. It's the time has gone by pretty fast, and we've had a lot of conversations, seen a lot of different market situations, but it's been a pleasure to work with you, and I wish you continued success. I know you'll continue to do a good job.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got to the point where you are today. You've been 40 years at the University of Illinois, but how did you get to the University of Illinois and your current position, and where did you come from?
Well, briefly, I'm a native of Illinois, Edgar County. Got a bachelor's degree at Southern Illinois University, PhD at Michigan State. Took my first professional position at Cornell University in the fall of 1972. Spent 4 years on the faculty there. Came to the University of Illinois late summer 1976. It was at that time, if people recall, we were coming out of a period of a spike in commodity prices there in 1973, 1974, and it was at that time that the Department of Ag Economics decided to ramp up its efforts in a marketing price outlook and opened up a couple of new positions, and I was able to be hired under that new effort and primarily an extension position, a three-quarter time extension, and that while the methods have changed over time, that's basically what I've been involved in the last 40 years is trying to follow, analyze the markets, and provide information and analysis to the farming community.
And of course, I've been writing the Weekly Outlook for a long time. The number is something like 1,500 articles for the Weekly Outlook. But when you do the multiplication, when you look at the total number of years, there must have been some other folks to begin with. Who did you work with up front?
Well, there were a number of people. The driving force at that time was Tom Hieronymus. He had been on the teaching research faculty at Illinois and was persuaded to move over into the extension effort and headed up that new effort in 1975, 1976. So I came alongside Tom. We had a number of people working in the marketing and farm management area that kind of dovetailed at that time. Harold Geither, Al Mueller, John Scott, Bryce Kirtley, Bob Swart. I'm probably missing a number of people here. So we all at that time worked together, contributed to the Weekly Outlook letter, did extension programs together, and tried to cover a multitude of topics, much like we do today with the FarmDoc effort, where we've brought together a number of faculty people. The difference is I think we have stronger analytical capabilities now. We've been able to entice some of the research faculty into joining the FarmDoc team, and the delivery certainly is much more efficient than it was 40 years ago when it was basically face-to-face meetings and some hard copy publications.
What was it like in those first 10 years, 76 to 86? We're just coming off of a really big spike. By the time 1986 rolled around, we were at the bottom of a really bad time for agriculture.
No, you're right. The early part of that was pretty exciting. I mean, there was a lot of interest in learning about marketing and marketing tools and marketing strategies and understanding price-making forces. And we were able to develop some fairly intensive seminars and workshops that we paraded around the state. We had a series where we did 4 hours at a time for 4 weeks, teaching marketing to various folks, and there was a lot of interest in that because prices had recently expanded from the, kind of the doldrums of the 60s, and there was a lot of interest, pretty big attendance at our meetings, and was, I think, a good opportunity for all of us to learn and interact. And then, of course, came the mid-80s when things slowed down and it became more of a survival mentality for a lot of producers, how to get through a period of high interest rates, high costs, low commodity prices. And then, you know, more recently, we've cycled back in the last decade to another spike in prices that's reminiscent of the early 1970s. So it's a long cycle, but it does repeat itself to some extent.
Yeah, so 30 years from one end to the other, and it does repeat itself to some extent. I'm interested to know, on the outreach effort where you were hoping to teach marketing to folks, I assume farmers were among them, do you think that that was very impactful at that point? And how important was it? Should it be something that might be looked at again in the future? Because producers are always thinking about how to market a crop, and it's probably as difficult a problem as they have with as least amount of help as they might be able to find.
Right. You know, I think the interest is still there on the part of farmers, but there are, I think, a lot more resources available to farmers than there was 40 years ago. Extension was a leading advocate of teaching marketing and pricing and price analysis. The private sector, the internet, of course, wasn't there. The private sector was really just gearing up because of this new price era that we had entered into. And it was challenging because Extension was in the leadership there and was looked to for providing that kind of information. And I think it was very impactful for producers who had not been challenged really for a decade or so in terms of having to analyze prices and make marketing decisions because we'd been through a period of very flat prices. So I think it was effective. But now with the internet and with the private sector heavily involved in this, I think the need for public education probably has subsided somewhat. Not completely. I think what's still missing in the private sector is really the analysis of markets and maintaining a strong fundamental perspective on the markets. And I think that's where we found our niche.
I wanted to ask something about that because every day you're in the market, every day I'm in the market. I think we both understand that there's an ebb and a flow to the marketplace, that it has a rhythm to it. That's the trade part of it. But the analysis part of it for you is oftentimes very fundamental, oftentimes a lot of data that comes from many sources. What's your set of research tools or analytical tools that you go to? And then how do you take those numbers and start to build some analysis?
You know, the basic tool has remained fairly constant over time, and that's really the balance sheet for corn and soybeans supply, consumption, stocks, and price. And so the challenge is how to fill in the blanks on that balance sheet. So it's anticipating, for example, planted acres of corn and soybeans, doing the analysis of historical acreage and changes in acreage and what drives those changes, and try to use that to anticipate the coming year, look at yield trends. What are those trends? How do you form expectations about upcoming crop year in terms of production? And then on the consumption side, it's again having a strong understanding of historical trends and then staying on top of consumption data as it's released during the year. We have a large number of USDA and other reports that come out on a weekly or monthly, sometimes quarterly basis. And it's critical to be able to put those in context and continue to tweak your balance sheet, trying to get to the bottom line, how big or how small is a surplus going to be, and looking at the price implications of that surplus.
I'm thinking of a couple of things that may have changed the fundamental supply side over the decades. Of course, you were coming off of the export era when you started, or at least the beginnings of that. That number actually ramped up and then didn't change very much over the preceding or the decades afterwards. There were a couple of other things, and maybe you can help me out, but one of them, freedom to farm, which I think maybe changed the acreage mix across the United States, and then the RFS and the build-out of ethanol and capacity in the United States.
Yeah, you're right. In the early 70s, we had a real boom in exports, primarily corn and wheat, the feed grains and the food grains, and that really reflected a change in policy in the former Soviet Union. They became a major player on the consumption side, and then that tended to flatten out, and it has for several decades now. We really haven't trended higher or lower, a lot of variability, but no uptrend in exports. In contrast, the soybean market was not a participant in that early rally and has come on late now, with particularly with strong Chinese demand for soybeans. That's where the real growth has come. Freedom to farm, you're right. And in the old days, if you're thinking about corn or wheat acres, what you would say is, okay, we know what the base acres are for those crops. We know what the set-aside program is, and farmers' decisions are pretty straightforward. You can anticipate what's going to happen there. They're going to plant their base acres, and whatever the set-aside is, that's you do just do the arithmetic. With freedom to farm, then you had to pay more attention to, okay, what's the relative economics of the various crops, and is there incentive or motivation to move acreage from one crop to another, and how will producers respond to that? And that, I think, was really epitomized with the renewable fuels era beginning in the mid-decade, 2006-07, when ethanol use of corn really ramped up and really pushed a lot of acres towards corn for a few years. And now that's kind of played out, and now it's the soybean export boom that's kind of driving acreage decisions.
How hard or difficult was it during the development of the RFS of that capacity to realize how much corn was being moved into the marketplace? Of course, that was set by U.S. government, so that might have been not so hard. But the value of the DDGs, or the replacement of DDGs in the feed mix, and what that really meant, that seemed like it might have been the most difficult part of that equation to come up with an answer for.
Yeah, I think initially in the development of ethanol, DDGs was viewed strictly as a byproduct, and there was not a ready home for that. The livestock industry had not been exposed to that. That market had not been developed, and it became just really a disposable problem for much of the industry. And then as the dry milling came on and the dried distiller's grain became available, and livestock producers became aware through a lot of good university research about the feeding value of DDGs, they really found a home of their own, developed their own market domestically and export, and now they're really kind of equal co-products, ethanol and DDGs, that drive the value of the ethanol processing plant and the value of corn.
When we look forward to the advanced portion of the RFS, biofuels, in particular biodiesel made from soybeans, we have a product bean meal and a product bean oil. The oil used to make the diesel, the bean meal, the product that both have been around and have driven the price of soybeans for decades. However, there may be an abundant supply of bean meal. We have the research, I suppose. It's a different animal, I think, than the DDGs might have been when they first came onto the marketplace.
It is. I mean, when we process soybeans, you get a fixed amount of soybean oil and meal. Meal is not a storable commodity for the most part, so it's the demand for meal that drives the magnitude of crush, and that's the way it's been forever. If you have a surplus of oil, it gets stored. If you have a shortage, the price runs up to reduce consumption. I think the interesting question going forward is that paradigm subject to change, as we continue to expand biodiesel production, and soybean oil being one of the major feedstocks for biodiesel, you could envision a paradigm where the need for soybean oil begins to drive the magnitude of the domestic crush rather than meal demand. And if that's the case, then you have the potential of producing a quote-unquote surplus of meal, a non-storable commodity then that would have to be priced so that it's consumed. And what are the implications for that in terms of soybean meal prices relative to distiller grain, relative to corn? It would have to find a home in the marketplace somewhere and presumably push something out, would have to be priced to push something out. So I think that's we're kind of on the verge of exploring that question with the EPA's kind of push on biodiesel. And whether that continues or not under the new administration is going to be an important question.
How complicated was it when, after the turn of the century, Brazil began to produce more soybean acres and trying to figure out fundamentally how they worked into the marketplace, where they weren't a player, and over a 10-year period they became a major player to the point that in the coming season, 2017, they're likely to surpass the United States in soybean production?
Yeah, kind of the history of that is interesting. I think the soybean industry in Brazil really got a start from the embargo on U.S. soybean exports in 1973. Japan was a major buyer of U.S. soybeans, and when we embargoed those exports, it put a shock in their market, and their response was, we will invest in soybean production in South America. And that's really where that initiated, and then obviously discovered very quickly that soybeans did very well in Brazil, in South America. Plenty of land, opportunity to do that, and expanded very rapidly. So trying to figure out the rate of expansion there, how much of that was going to be available to the export market, and the timing of when that would compete with U.S. supplies was kind of a learning curve in figuring that out, and to some extent we're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, they're still in the process of ramping up to some great extent. And then I'm always surprised on the global front as it pertains to trade about the intricacies of geopolitical processes that impact what's happening in the marketplace, that it really does make a difference to what happens in Chicago with the price of futures and consequently what happens on the farm in Illinois or Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota.
It does impact, and probably long before my memory starts, but we talked about the export boom in the 1970s, and that was really a policy decision that was made in the Soviet Union. Prior to that, if the Soviet Union had a shortage of crop, they just tightened their belt and made do with what they had. They had a very major policy change in the early 70s and said, when we have a shortage, we're going to go to the world market. And the interesting thing is U.S. did not have an export reporting system at that point, so nobody knew what anybody else was doing in terms of selling grain to Russia until we basically ran out of wheat and said we'd overcommitted. And that's when we USDA really started the export reporting system so that we wouldn't get into that lack of information again. And then, you know, the decisions around the world in terms of trade policy, subsidies or not subsidies for domestic production, renewable fuels policies around the world all have impacts that come back to Central Illinois.
The one thing we haven't talked about very much is actual futures trade, whether that was be in Chicago, the old Kansas City Board of Trade, other places. There has been consolidation in that system. It went from public to private as well over the past 15 years. I'm wondering mostly about the wheat contracts themselves, because they seem to be a difficult problem for the trade, where hard red winter wheat used to lead. And now soft red winter wheat looks much more like a global commodity rather than a U.S.-based east of the Mississippi class of wheat?
Yeah, wheat is an interesting commodity because of two or three things. One, wheat is grown almost everywhere in the world, and unlike corn and soybeans, which are primarily kind of homogeneous commodities around the world, wheat is very different. They have very different classes of wheat, different growing seasons even within the same country. And so what happens is world wheat trading that tends to get concentrated in Chicago, that has been a soft red winter wheat contract, but traders are really trading that contract to reflect world conditions of a very heterogeneous commodity. And so at times you get into some issues about performance of the futures contracts. Most recently in Chicago was the lack of convergence on cash and futures prices at delivery points, and they addressed that by going to a variable storage rate. And then this year the same thing happened with hard red winter wheat and lack of convergence there. It's been an interesting history, a lot of changes, but wheat is in a lot of respects a very unique commodity.
Any final thoughts for us for the day as you kind of wrap up your period here at the University of Illinois? 40 years again, thank you so much for all you've done for me.
No, you'd like to be able to say, here's what the future looks like, and here's what we're going to be dealing with over the next decade or so, but that's really unknown. Right now, with where commodity prices are, you might say things look pretty dull, pretty unexciting, a lot of financial implications. But just as soon as you get satisfied with that scenario, things will change, just like they did in the 70s and again this past decade. So what that will look like, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure what we think of as pretty dull, quiet markets right now will change before we know it.
One other question. What do you recall about the beginnings of the agricultural programming at WILL? You and Paul Cooley and Paul Bates and Charlie Lindy and Dan Simeone working to put that programming content together that still exists today on the radio station?
Yeah, I was a bit on the periphery of that. I mean, I was pulled in early on, and the initiative obviously started with WILL and Charlie Lindy, but they sensed a need for more market information, more price information to their listenership. And I think by talking to some in the industry said, you know, what we really need to hear is on a more regular basis what experts are thinking about markets and market trends and pricing strategies. And so the concept was developed, let's put together a panel. Let's interview that panel on a weekly basis and get that diverse opinion out to our listenership. And so it felt like they needed industry folks as well as some academics involved in that. And so I was involved early on in that process and was involved for a number of years. And of course, under your leadership, that continues to be a very popular outlet. And I know you have industry folks who are eager and anxious to be part of that effort, and it's gained a really tremendous reputation, I think, around not only in Illinois and in the kind of the immediate listenership area, but because of the internet now, nationwide, a lot of interest in that program and what you've put together there. So I'm hopeful that continues another decade or so, too.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to that continuing. Thank you so much for the kind comments. Thank you for all that you've done for me over the past three decades working with you. I have learned so very much. And for the way that you work with the media in general, that you really do take the time and say, well, that's not a stupid question. You don't really tell us that. Yeah. You just answer us back and say, well, how about we look at it in this way? And that gentle push is always very much appreciated.
Well, it's been a pleasure. A lot of quality folks in the agricultural media, and they've always been kind to me. And it's, as I said, been a pleasure to work with them. And it's a two-way street.
Darryl Good is an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. He will retire at the end of the 2016 year.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.